Yes. I'm assuming you would be interested in doing that. The opportunity to work with Celine isn't extended to just anyone. I knew that all too well. Celine's exclusive internship was the first one I applied to when I left culinary school. Anyone who completes it can walk into a job with the most talented chefs in the industry. It's career-changing. I managed to keep calm as Zola and I arrange a date a few weeks from now. I'll need to be prepared to do a trial run, working the lunch shift, then sit down for a chat with Celine after. For a chat? How is this my life? We offer to drop Zola back to the train station, and as Henry carries our boxes through the rain to the rental van, it dawns on me I should probably ask what role I'll be interviewing for. Celine is opening a new plant-centric restaurant in New York, Zola says. She's been on the hunt for talent for a while now. I think you've got the fresh perspective she's been looking for. I'm sorry, did you say New York? She nods. If you're successful, your visa and travel expenses will be taken care of and your accommodation subsidized. Celine is quite serious about this endeavor. She'll do whatever it takes to build a happy team. Zola nods. There's a spark in her eyes that tells me I'd be crazy to turn this down. Have you ever been to New York before? No, I say. I remember being 12 years old, Mum and Dad coming back from a business trip with a snow globe, a Christmassy Empire State Building inside. I asked if I could join them next time. The answer was always no. Never had the chance, I add. Oh, you'll love it. Beautiful city. Some of the best culinary experiences in the world. Where's that? Henry says, popping his head back into the tent, his hair drenched and stuck to his forehead. He grabs the final box. There's a flash of terror in me. I know I should tell him the truth, to not make old mistakes again, but a louder part of my brain is screaming that it isn't even real yet. It's only an interview. I don't want to ruin the next few weeks stressing about something that might never happen. Winchester, I say. Obviously. He laughs. Damn straight. Where else are you going to find an establishment that wraps chips inside a calzone? Zola looks at me. I silently beg her not to tell him. So she smiles and says, tough to beat. Once we drop Zola at the station, we crawl along the motorway. The rain is still heavy, and so is the silence between us. I know Henry is quiet because he's tired and wet and cold, but I'm an anxious wreck. I haven't even got the job and I'm already considering turning it down. I stare at the side of his handsome face, his exhausted eyes, his hand on the gear stick. I love everything about him, and I've fought so hard to keep him in my life. Do I really want to throw that all away and move across the Atlantic? Without him? I feel sick to my stomach for keeping this to myself, but then I think of all the things he's kept from me. The lies he told before. He notices me staring. What's up? I was thinking about your brother, I say. Henry raises an eyebrow. Should I be worried? Not like that, I say, and he laughs. I really tried not to listen, but I couldn't help but overhear. Yeah, Tom has some very loud opinions, he says with a tight sigh. You never talk about your parents. I kind of got the impression they'd died. I say it as gently as I can. This Henry didn't lie to me. It's not his fault. Well, that's because I wish they had. He cuts a sharp look to me. That's awful, right? The worst thing I could say. I'm speechless. Utterly speechless. Everything I thought I knew about his life is disintegrating before me. The assumptions, the misconceptions. I don't understand any of it. When I was younger, I would always lie and tell people they were dead. It made it easier, somehow. Instantly stopped any questions. For the longest time, I needed that. To not talk about what happened to me. But my therapist says I shouldn't keep my past hidden from the people I care about, he says. And I care about you. I promised myself the first time you brought it up, I would tell you the truth. I don't want this hanging over us. Your therapist? He checks his wing mirror and nods. There's a scheme at work. I signed up. For all my nagging at Ali to try it, it was pretty hypocritical to not do it myself. It dawns on me that I've not only dramatically changed my life, but his too. I'm proud of you, I say. Henry hits the brakes again as we stop for traffic, then slowly exhales, as if this is a conversation he'd rather not have. But there's no avoiding it now. For the first time since the glitch, I have no idea what's coming next. They were imprisoned when I turned 8. It feels like that's my first memory. There's not much before it but blurs of sadness and my brother's faces. A random Christmas where everything felt sort of happy. After their conviction, I didn't have contact for a long time. The social workers said the less I knew, the better. But when I turned 16, they finally sat me down and showed me the case files. And lots of things I'd always thought were bad dreams came up as fact. Henry. I'm gripping his hand, squeezing. I'm here. I'm telling him. I'm here. I visited them a few times, much to my brother's dismay. But when I started university, I pulled back again. It got too tough. Mum kept telling me I didn't remember things correctly, that they hadn't done the things I'd been told they had. Dad was just miserable. I started drinking a lot, partying. You know, when I told you in Solcombe that I drank to forget my real life? I nod. That's why. It was a slippery slope. And I learned the hard way that a few hours of numb silence is never, ever worth it. I don't know if I should ask this, but the truth rests on it. What were they imprisoned for? The way Henry talks about it, so emotionless, I half expect him to say that they were falsely imprisoned after allegations they couldn't fight. But he keeps his empty gaze fixed on the windscreen and says the words like they slice his tongue. Drug charges, GBH, and child neglect. Henry, I gasp. Me and my brothers were at the bottom of a long list of priorities, all of which revolved around booze and white lines. We were left to fend for ourselves a lot, and people noticed things were going on, and no one stepped in. Everyone felt it wasn't their place. 8 years of my life, no one put me first. I think of 5 years ago, when I didn't put him first, when I put my dream above him, and then the desolate look in his eyes when I finally told him the truth. Tears burn my eyes. I wish we weren't in this van. I wish I could climb into his lap and hold him. I wrote to them both earlier this year, never heard back. Until that card arrived on my birthday. A prison stamp on the back. Turns out my dad's health isn't great. He'll probably be dead within the next 3 years. I thought if I went to see them again, I could get some answers. Some clarity. That's what Tom and I were talking about. What does he think? He thinks I shouldn't. I'm inclined to take his advice. If anyone knows them as well as I do, it's him. But if you want to, I say, nervously questioning everything before it leaves my mouth, then you should, no? I'm still deciding what I want. Their arrest was one of the most terrifying things I've ever experienced. The police broke the door down in the middle of the night. Me and my brothers were put in the back of a nice lady's car. Our newly assigned social worker. She gave us cookies, the first thing I'd eaten in days. And we were so hungry we ate them in seconds flat, then picked the crumbs out of our laps. I thought I'd be safe because I was with Tom and Oliver. But they were older, which was a problem. They were never going to find someone to take on 3 of us. I spent the first few nights in emergency care. I have a memory of a bed with a hedgehog duvet. It felt like the most luxurious thing ever. But I was so alone and so scared. Then I got moved to a family, and they gave me a whole bedroom to myself. I put my beaten stack of dinosaur stickers in the wardrobe. That was all I had to unpack. For the first time in my life, I had food and a warm house, and people who smiled when they saw me. but it was only a temporary solution. I was there for a month before the first of so many moves, I lost count. And that's the crux of the issue. The system is all for now, never for long. My brothers were put into one of those group home places. Hell on earth. So I could have had it worse.
Did you at least have a good experience in foster care?
I ask, already dreading the answer.
His laugh is painful.
Some places were marginally better than others. But overall, no. I was never there long enough to settle. And with every move, I became more withdrawn, struggled to make friends. When I was 14, I was placed with the Tonga family. Tilda was a GP, and her husband was a cardiac nurse, he says pointedly. I was picking my subjects for GCSE at the time, making decisions on my future. They said they'd help me with biology, that I'd be good at it. It was the only positive thing I got out of the care system.
And they were nice?
I ask, clinging to any scraps of joy I can. They were lovely. They introduced me to a few support groups, online forums for children in the system to connect. That's how I met Ali. We began emailing, then upgraded to phone calls where we could trauma dump, he says. I had my brothers, but our experiences were so different. What with them being in a group home, then being shoehorned into the armed forces, I felt really detached from them, physically and emotionally. For a long time, Ali was the only one who understood me, my situation. I touch his hand. I'm glad you had someone to help you through it. And I mean it, despite the wobble in my voice. There was a period, the summer before I started university. I was officially out of the system and supposed to be moving onto campus in July, but I'd got the paperwork mixed up. Turns out my accommodation wasn't accessible until mid-September. I couchsurfed for the first few weeks of summer, but it didn't take long to outstay my welcome. And after using up all my favours, eventually I had nowhere to go. My brothers were in barracks. The Tongas, the only foster family I trusted, were on sabbatical in Asia. I was officially homeless, sleeping rough. Ali was the only one who knew what was going on. I remember calling her, cold and alone, frightened as hell in this doorway in Winley. And I swore I was never going to be in that position again. I was going to start university, get a job at the same time, and work my bollocks off so that I never had to live like that again. My brothers and I launched a civil claim against our parents, and I got some compensation when I turned 20. It wasn't a massive amount, but it was enough to get my savings pot started. People called me cheap all the time, said I was stingy. I never cared. Working hard, turning that money into stability, was all I cared about.
I sit back in my seat, realization hitting me. That money, it was everything, I say. My seatbelt feels like it's slicing into my skin.
The air feels too heavy to inhale. That's why it's so important for you, to own a house. Yeah, he says. It's the one thing I've never had. A home that no one can take away from me. The van feels like it's swirling around me. I grip the dashboard, my heart pounding in my ears, my throat burning. I'm plagued by a memory I never fully understood. When Dottie offered to put up her bungalow as collateral to help me launch my dream, it was the most amazing thing anyone had ever done for me, and I swore I would do whatever it took to make sure she kept her home. I knew I'd hurt Henry, knew I'd let him down. But I softened my guilt with the knowledge that it all worked out. That by the time she needed to sell her bungalow to pay for her care, that debt was cleared. But now I'm zooming out. I'm seeing Henry, years later, still paying the price for my failings. The biggest mistake of my life now feels infinitely worse. I took it away from him. His dream. His home. I did that. I hate old Grace. I hate myself. Henry, I am so, so sorry.
It comes out of my mouth before I can stop it. His eyebrows pinch together.
What for?
I'm so far from that path, from that life-altering mistake. But I still feel it, cutting me up, beating me from the inside. He deserves so much better.
For
everything. For everything that's happened. For you not having your own home.
For...
He shakes his head with a resigned sigh.
You don't need to say sorry for things you haven't done, Grace.
The instant we pull onto my driveway, I'm out of the van, opening his door, pulling him to my chest, holding him there. Then I look deep into his eyes, seeing a long-lost version of him. A frightened boy who never had a safe place. A grown man working his arse off to make something of himself.
I'm so sorry,
I say again. Then I show him how much he means to me. With my heart, with my mouth, and finally, when we climb into bed, with my body.
Chapter 23, Henry, 5 years earlier. She did it. She bloody did it. Grace stood proudly in her chef whites, the lucky one hand-stitched in gold below her right shoulder as a photographer from the local newspaper snapped away. Behind was her new team, her sous chef Rhonda, who had cooked the most incredible pulled pork I'd ever eaten. Her lead waiter, an upbeat guy called Patrick with the charisma of a showman. A sweet blonde girl called Annika, who looked so excited to be here. Plus a few more wait staff I hadn't been introduced to. They smiled for the pictures, then got to work. Grace was the go-between for the kitchen and front of house. She schmoozed her guests, some local bloggers and press contacts, as well as some influential business owners in the area, while dipping in and out of the kitchen for quality control. I loved watching her come alive. In her element. I helped as much as I could, taking out the rubbish, scrubbing pots, keeping Dottie company at the bar and making sure her gin and tonics were consumed at a sensible pace. But mostly, I tried to stay out of the way. This was Grace's big night. As everyone was seated for the first course, the food bloggers and critics making all the right noises, the reporter asked for one more photograph. Grace and her family out front. She took my hand without a word, like it wasn't even a question. Her family. She wanted me in this memory, a permanent presence. The picture was taken and I tried my hardest to contain my clown-like grin. I didn't do a very good job. Dottie quickly grew cold and returned inside. The reporter asked us a few more questions, typing the answers into his phone as he went. Who am I? What do I do? Am I proud of her achievements? Henry, boyfriend, nurse. Like you wouldn't believe. Oh, apologies, the reporter said, scrolling up. I've noted you down as husband. I smiled and looked at Grace and said, someday. It was a few hours later when everything finally wound down. The plates were empty, the glasses almost. Sasha and Roman had been and gone, along with a few of Grace's old colleagues from Le Bleu. I got stuck in with the clean-up while Dottie propped up the bar. She'd sunk more than a couple. It was high time we got her out of here. Grace agreed. Dottie looks like she's about to fall asleep on the stool, she said. I haven't spoken to her as much as I'd have liked. Is she okay? She's fine. Getting the bar sales off to a strong start, I replied. I'm almost finished up in here. Is there anything else I can do? She kissed me on the cheek. You're amazing. I'm so lucky. I think this is the happiest day of my whole life. I smiled. So far. So far. Grace agreed. Her blue eyes filled with excitement, and I saw our distant future as if it had already happened. Launching our careers, living together, getting engaged, building our entire lives, And then I saw our close future. Us tonight, in her bed. Me showing her how proud of her I was. Are we getting the train home, or? I asked. The staff had gravitated to a table in the middle of the restaurant, along with some guy who owned the local car dealership and a couple of people from Southampton Football Club. Influential. Good for business. Three bottles of champagne and some whiskies between them. She looked at them, torn. They all erupted in laughter. I wasn't going to let her moment be over yet. Stay, I said. Bond with your new team, make some connections. Soak it all up. No, it's fine. I'll lock up and send them to the pub. No, please. This is your night. You're sure? I twisted her hand in mine. Certain, I said. I'm going to head back to yours, shower, and wait in bed for you. Grace's eyebrow rose. Her laugh was filthy. How about you save the shower until I get home? Deal, I said. I kissed her on the forehead and left her to celebrate. Dottie was still feeling cold, so I forked out for a taxi back to Winchester to save her the hassle of public transport. Dottie pulled the seatbelt around her, rubbing her breastbone like she'd done the day we met at her bungalow. She'd said nothing since we left the restaurant. Everything all right? I asked. A little indigestion, she said. Nothing to worry about. When we pulled up outside her bungalow, I told the driver to wait while I walked her to the front door. I'm old, not ancient. Dottie sulked as I looped my arm around hers. I've walked this path 1,000 times before. So humour me, I said. She let out a resigned huff, finding her key and sliding it into the lock. You'll be okay? I asked. I can come in while you get settled. Not necessary, my love. I've lived alone a long time now. She paused to cough. I know what I'm doing. As she closed the door, I put my hand out, blocking it. I'd known something was wrong the day we met. And by the sound of that cough, it was getting worse. Promise me you'll speak to your GP, I said. She nodded once. She didn't need to ask me what for. Good night, Henry. A few weeks later, Grace came with me to view the house I would end up putting an offer on. A small property with wood chip walls and popcorn ceilings. It was hideous. It needed so much work. But it was home, the minute I stepped foot inside. There was lots of competition and the estate agents warned me it would be sold by the end of the day. Half of my deposit was still tied up with a lucky one. But I already had my mortgage agreed in principle from before I'd lent Grace the money, and she assured me I'd have it all back in a few weeks. She was adamant that I couldn't miss out, that this house would be perfect once I got my hands on it. I had to put an offer in. And so I did. And it was accepted, subject to contract. It would be months of paperwork and surveys and fees, but finally, I'd done it. Grace and I celebrated by getting a takeaway and having sex on her sofa. And I swear, I almost asked her to live with me right in the middle of it. I decided I would wait until I had the keys in my hands, that it wasn't fair to add the stress of moving while the restaurant was so new, but damn, I wanted to. I pulled back, watching her move over me. I wanted to tell Grace how my whole life was finally starting to feel worth it. As if I'd spent all that time climbing a hellish mountain and I was now, finally, at the top enjoying the view. My chest ached with something I knew couldn't be pain. Grace stilled. You okay? She said, a little shy. I looked into her eyes, saying the first words that came to mind. I'm never getting over you. I didn't know exactly what I meant, only that I was happy, and I knew, bone deep, that my feelings for her were never going away. Grace seemed to understand because she smiled, then kissed me, her hands on my cheeks. You won't ever need to, she replied. But I would wonder, years later, if on some level I'd known that that would be the last moment where everything was perfect. By December, the restaurant was busy, the reservations filled with Christmas celebrations, and Grace was working 7 days a week. She spent her days on site, prepping, doing paperwork, her evenings managing the chaos of a frantic kitchen. We were both so exhausted. It wasn't uncommon for me to walk in her front door and find her already asleep, for silence to roll on from one day to another. The only communication, a late-night text confirming we were still surviving, still pushing through the whirlwind of adulting. It was the closest long-distance relationship ever. A week out from Christmas, it had been weeks of absence. I missed her. Her voice and her smile. I was determined to turn things around. Grace's texts had been getting shorter, her phone calls briefer. Letting the stress of a new business and a house move get in the way of our relationship was an unconscious decision, one we'd been making for over a month. I was going to unmake it. Before I arrived for my shift that day, I'd messaged Grace to tell her I was coming over in the evening, that I'd meet her outside the restaurant like I did in the old days at Le Bleu, that I couldn't wait to see her. I spent the whole day looking forward to it, walking from bed to bed with a spring in my step. But when I clocked off, changed out of my scrubs, grabbed my backpack from my locker and opened my phone, I was gutted. I stopped at the nurse's station, phone in hand. I didn't realise how long I'd been sitting there until Mikkel rounded the desk, waving a clipboard in my face. "Earth to Henry," he said. I snapped back to the moment, looking up from the screen. "What's that?" I asked. "Your shift finished 10 minutes ago. Why are you still hanging around?" I read the message for the umpteenth time. "Tonight isn't great. I've got so much to take care of. Head home and we'll talk tomorrow. Kiss." It had been 3 weeks since I'd last seen her properly, the longest rolling absence since we'd met. She couldn't spare me a few hours? It didn't seem right. Grace used to cherish the moments we could be together, even if it was only 20 minutes in her bed before I fell asleep and she got up for the day. Now, there was nothing but excuses, reasons to avoid me. I was starting to feel, and I hated to even think it, like a burden. "Yeah," I said to Mikkel, pretending the burning concern in my chest didn't exist. "Heading out now." I picked up my rucksack and made for the elevators. On the way out, I called Grace a couple of times. No answer. A shiver ripped through me when I walked out of the double doors into the night air. I checked the time. 10:30. Service would have finished by now, or thereabouts. She'd be cleaning up. Maybe I could say I didn't see her message. Maybe I could surprise her. Help with the lockup like I used to. Prove to her that I would willingly work a 12-hour shift, jump on a train just to end up doing more work, as long as I was next to her. 20 minutes later and I was in Winley. I crossed the road towards the centre. The pubs were filled with raucous Christmas parties, smokers wrapped in tinsel spilling onto the streets, all of them too drunk to understand the words, "Excuse me." I ducked my shoulder to squeeze past when someone grabbed my arm. "Hey, stranger," they said. I turned to see Mia Baron. I hadn't seen her since that awkward encounter outside the train station with Grace. I looked at the restaurant ahead of me, glowing gold in the darkness. I didn't have time for this. "Oh, hey," I replied. She flicked her cigarette before leaning in for a hug. When she moved away, she shimmied her dress an inch further down her thigh. "What are you doing back in these ends and not telling me?" She didn't give me time to answer. "Me and the gang are having a few drinks. Come join us." "I really can't."
"But we haven't seen you in forever,"
she said, red lips pouting. I would usually have felt guilty, but I didn't. It wasn't friendship I shared with these people, it was misery. "I know, things are different for me now. I've fallen out of the whole party scene," I said, slowly backing away. She playfully rolled her eyes.
"Well, if you change your mind..."
"You'll be the first to know," I replied, before heading on my way. I reached the window of the Lucky One. The chairs were stacked on the tables already. The closed sign flipped over. I spotted Grace at a table in the back. Two glasses of caramel-coloured spirit and an open bottle on the table. It was a gut-wrenching unveiling. A curtain falling as I saw a young blonde guy laughing his head off at something she'd said. I recognised him from the night at the restaurant opening. One of the football players for Southampton. Grace erupted in laughter, eyes to the ceiling, shoulders shaking. Totally over the top. She reached out and touched his arm. He couldn't take his eyes from her chest. Oh, hell no. I opened the door like I was going to take it off the hinges. The startle in both their bodies was like a bazooka going off in my head.
"Henry,"
Grace said. She dragged her seat back, standing to greet me. I have no idea how, but I kept my cool. "Am I interrupting?"
"Of course not," she replied.
The guy sat back in his seat, ran his hand through his short hair, Rolex catching in the dim lighting. She looked between us.
"I texted you. I was going to be here late."
"Did you?" I replied, teeth grinding. "Huh. Must have not come through." She studied my face, then looked behind her as if remembering her manners.
"This is Lars. Did you meet him when we opened?"
I can't remember. He's recently signed for Southampton Football Club. He's been one of our biggest advocates. Brought in so many of his teammates too."
"I bet he has."
Grace's voice was sprightly and excited, her words believable. But something was off. And maybe it was the fact that this handsome millionaire wouldn't stop staring at her. Or the way she flustered through her words. The jittery nervousness of a child caught with a permanent marker. But I knew.
"Nice to meet you,"
I said. I shook his hand. I'm not proud of how tight I squeezed it.
"Likewise," Lars said.
He stood then, putting on his black coat, slipping Grace a card with his number on it, as though I wasn't standing right there.
"We can catch up at another time," he said.
"Not before midday, though," she said, and he laughed. They had private jokes? Seriously? "I'm going to grab my coat," Grace said, heading into the office. The door swung shut behind her. I stared her evening guest down.
"Come here often?"
He laughed.
"Yeah, I love it. Great food, truly delicious."
I'd never been jealous before in my life, but now the emotion roared through my veins. A feral, animalistic feeling. I suddenly understood the lions in those Attenborough documentaries, the ferocious defence against a rival pride. Grace reappeared, smiling, the keys jangled in her hand.
"Let's go,"
she said. The three of us walked onto the street. She locked up behind us. Lars climbed into the front seat of a white Porsche, but not before saying goodbye to Grace with a wink, and then saluting me. Prick. Grace and I walked to the station. She kept her head low, hardly looked at me,
Busy night? I asked.
She shrugged.
Shrugged?
Grace, I said when we reached the platform. What was that?
He's just a customer.
She kept her eyes on the tracks. I felt like I had rocks in my stomach.
A customer.
Right. We boarded the last train to Winchester. She sat opposite me, attention fixed on her phone. I knew I should leave it, that picking at this was only going to make it worse. But I couldn't let it lie. You know, for someone who's been cheated on, what you're doing right now is beyond cruel. Her eyes snapped to mine.
Excuse me?
You know exactly what that looked like.
It looked like me having a conversation with a customer, a wealthy one, who could make my business.
What would have happened if I hadn't surprised you? Or would you have gone home with him? Or just screwed him right there in the middle of the restaurant?
Henry, she gasped. What the hell?
I understood her shock. This was so out of character, even I was confused. But I was fueled by juvenile suspicion and the self-satisfied look in Lars's eye, the one that signalled she might be yours, but not for long.
Well, would you?
No, she cried. A group of girls further along the carriage erupted in cackled laughter. We saved the rest of the fight until we walked in her front door. She had the demeanour of a caged animal, shoulders packed with fury, jaw tight. But she still closed the door quietly. She took off her shoes and put them away. She placed her coat on the back of a dining chair and looked at me. The second I saw her teary eyes, the jealousy evaporated. Making Grace cry, a fresh type of torture.
I'm sorry, I said.
I wrapped my arms around her. I'm miserable and stressed and overworked. I'm seeing things that aren't there.
I've missed you.
Being apart has driven me crazy.
You have nothing to be sorry for.
I do. I was rude. I accused you of something I should never have. I've been so worried you're pulling away from me, that you've outgrown me. A lightning rod of pain flashed through my heart. Being abandoned, of having the people who are supposed to love you the hardest, the longest, no longer care if you even exist. I took a deep breath, refusing to let the feeling stay. And then I thought you were flirting, that it confirmed what I'd been worried about, but I was wrong, and I'm so sorry. Please don't cry. She twisted her face away from me in a way that made me pause, that halted a breath in the back of my throat.
What is it? I need to tell you something.
I let her go, anxiety wrapping around my chest again, freezing my heart. Silence. Then more.
Grace, if you don't say something, I'm going to pass out. I was flirting with him, she blurted. A little. Professionally.
Professional flirting? I laughed at how absurd it sounded, then realised nothing about this was funny.
He's been coming in once a week, flashing the cash, acting the big shot, and I saw an opportunity.
My focus narrowed to the single guilty tear resting on her lip.
Opportunity for what?
Investment, she whispered. That wasn't what I thought she was going to say. I took a long breath.
Okay.
My brain was trying to unscramble a puzzle with only half the pieces.
Why do you need investment?
You said things were going well.
That you booked solid all month.
We are, but... She turned away, facing into the low light of the kitchen.
Everything is so expensive. Every night is a struggle to break even. I knew it would be tough at the beginning, that it takes time for things to settle. But it is so, so much harder than I thought it was going to be. I have no idea what I'm doing. I'm trained as a chef, not an entrepreneur.
Grace pressed her hands against her eyes.
I've been so stressed. I'm breaking out in hives. I'm a nervous wreck. That's why I've pulled away, why I've been keeping you at arm's reach. Because I'm hanging on by my fingertips, watching every penny, doing everything I can think of to make sure Dottie keeps her house, to find the money to repay you.
When she looked at me, I knew what she was trying to tell me, what she'd truly been hiding from me. My money, I said, finally understanding. It's gone.
It's not gone. Well, it is, but I'll get it back. It might take...
I sat down, body thudding against the wooden chair. How long? I asked. She looked at the floor. Grace!
If I get some external investment, then it will be right away, but without that...
I could see her doing the maths. She screwed her eyes closed when she said,
at least a year.
If ever, I guessed. She didn't nod. She didn't need to. My new house. My dream home. That was all it was ever going to be. A fantasy. You told me to put in that offer. You said I'd have the money back. Jesus, Grace! I gripped my hair and tugged. There's a contract being drawn up with my name on it. I've paid for surveys. I've already given notice to my landlord. I'm going to lose. I have nowhere to live. It was hard to breathe. I feared I might throw up. I crouched over the dining table as memories from the darkest part of my mind slammed into my vision. 18. Alone. Homeless.
You can stay here until we figure something out, she said.
Now it's we? The insinuation we were in this mess together left a foul, bitter taste on my tongue. How could you do this to me? If I hadn't shown up tonight, would you have even told me? A fresh tear rolled down her cheek.
I was hoping I wouldn't need to. I didn't want you to lose your dream home. I thought I could fix it before it came to that.
By professionally flirting, I snarled. Yeah, you're right. Maybe you don't know how to be an entrepreneur. It was the first time I'd ever doubted her, ever reined in the ambition I'd helped her build. And I felt like a total twat as soon as I said it.
What was I supposed to do? She sobbed.
Communicate! I said, louder than I intended. She stepped back. I knew it was risky to hand over that kind of money no matter the circumstance, but what I never expected was the silence, the lies, the backtracking. Not from Grace. I repeated the word after I'd steadied myself.
Talk to me! Tell me what was happening! I could have planned! I could have not put in an offer! I didn't want to let you down, Grace said, barely a whimper.
Well, you did it anyway! I picked up my coat. Congratulations. I walked to the door. Grace rushed after me, putting her hands on my shoulders.
Please don't go. Please, let's talk about this.
Blood roared in my ears. I was so angry. I knew if I stayed, I was going to say something I'd regret. I think it's a little late for talking. It was my biggest fears combined, losing my home and the people who were supposed to love me treating me as nothing more than a burden, a stepping stone to what they really wanted. Both were now a reality. Of all the people
in my life I've expected this from. You were never one of them, I said. Please, no, don't. I opened the door. Henry, she cried. I turned to look at her, tears in my eyes. This is over. The words felt like a blunt knife to the heart. The mere thought of it being true was intense enough to knock me sideways. But then I thought of what she'd done. How long she'd hidden this. My brain was filled with fog, my nerves fraught. I sucked air through my teeth. There was only one thing I could say to that. I don't know.
Chapter 24. Grace. Now. After Henry's confession about his parents, about his money, when I realised that what I'd done was so much worse than I ever appreciated, I go into full reparation mode. I make him pack lunches for his shifts, cook him dinners and leave them in Tupperware boxes with notes covered in love hearts in the fridge for when he gets home. I wash his hair and hold his hand and love him the way he deserves to be loved. And then, when his house comes onto a property website, the hideous green bathroom, the red carpets, the popcorn ceilings, I make sure he's the first to view it, the only one. I become the estate agent's worst nightmare as I negotiate by whatever means to get him that house, to make his dream come true. And it does. Once again, that house is his. Well, it will be, once the contracts are exchanged and his money, that I'll never touch again, is handed over. Henry's happier than I've ever seen him. And we're together. And all thoughts of New York are in the back of my mind, until I know for sure, until it's real. We spend our weekends packing up his and Ali's rental house. Despite Henry and me gently trying to persuade her out of it, Ali decides to move in with Marcus. She seems excited. That's all that matters. So the three of us drink wine and clean and laugh about the questionable stains on the carpet from the party almost a year before. We find a pair of old blue granddad briefs down the back of the bathroom toilet, and Henry swears blind they aren't his, that they must be from a previous tenant, but we keep putting them in his underwear drawer for the fun of it. In between, I prep for my interview, watching every cooking show Celine has ever made, twice. I study all her interviews, and the prodigies who've trained and come up under her too. When I opened my restaurant, I had this underlying feeling of trepidation, that it was so much bigger than I was, that even the concept of starting my own business loomed over me like redwoods in a dark, whimsical forest. I don't feel like that when I take the train up to London, when I walk into Celine's fancy glass-walled restaurant, when I don my chef whites and get to work, proving to her, her staff, and most importantly, myself, that I can do this, that I am good enough. So how did it go? When I get home, Henry is waiting in my kitchen with open arms, a beaming smile on his face. I expect there's a bottle chilling in the fridge, as if a negative answer to that question isn't in the realm of feasibility, as if he doesn't know how badly I can screw up. The soles of my feet are burning, my neck aches, and my skin feels dry from the heat of the stoves, but my heart feels full, as though I've stepped back into the one place that makes me feel alive, a busy kitchen. I laugh in sheer disbelief, knowing it won't feel real until I tell him, until I see his reaction. I got it! I tell Henry how Celine was incredible, the most enigmatic, talented chef I've ever seen in a kitchen. She was firm but kind, authoritative but not cruel, unlike so many other chefs I've worked under. And the menu! My vegetable-filled heart is in awe at what I would be cooking, the fresh ingredients I'd get to work with. The learning curve is going to be mountainous, the hours long. But with Celine as my mentor, I'm ready. For the first time, I'm not scared of the challenge. I'm not waiting to fall. This is what I'm supposed to be doing with my life. Henry is bouncing off the walls. He's celebrating like we've hit the jackpot.
grabbing champagne from the fridge, telling me over and over again how happy he is for me, that he never had a doubt. I enjoy it for a minute, watching him swell with pride, falling in love with his earnest smile all over again, because I'm about to wipe it from his face. The job is in New York. And there it is. The pause. The slow fade into darkness. The expression I hate the most. Disappointment. I vowed never to make him look like that again. And here I am. Round two. The job is in New York? He repeats. As in, across the Atlantic? I nod. I'm on the verge of tears, and I can't tell which ones are happy and which ones are sad. Oh God, he says. I know, I was going to tell you sooner, but I wanted to see if I got it first. I didn't want to put pressure on us if it wasn't going to be a reality. Henry is very still. He's not speaking. But maybe I should have told you straight away, because now you're freaking out. Not freaking out, he corrects. Just absorbing. I want to be with you, I say. If I do this, I'm only leaving the country. I'm not leaving you. We can make this work, however it ends up looking. If you want to, that is. He wraps his hands around the neck of the champagne bottle, and just when I think he's about to put it down and tell me all the reasons it won't work, he pops it. The cork hits the ceiling hard enough to leave a dent. I duck. Then realize Henry's smile is back. He kisses me, then grabs two glasses and fills them to the brim. I am so unbelievably proud of you. I watch him, slightly confused. So you're okay with this? Because it's so far, and we've only officially been together for a few months. And if it's too messy for you, then... I'm welling up at only the thought of walking away from him again. Grace. Henry says, gently, putting his glass aside. I'll be honest. I was already prepared for some disruption. I thought you were going to walk in here and say you were moving to London. So New York is a little bit further. Oh well, he laughs. I know it's not exactly what we pictured, but that doesn't matter to me. I want to be with you, no matter where in the world you are. He pulls me to his chest. So, we'll do long distance? I ask. You'll be here, I'll be there, and we'll make it work, he says, smoothing his hand down my hair. I'll save all my annual leave to visit. You can fly home for the holidays. Video calls between. You'll get settled, do what you need to, then we'll make a long-term plan. We'll be fine. I press deeper into him, wanting to believe him. Trusting in his certain tone and calm demeanor. But there's one thing that gives him away. The way his heartbeat picks up, pounding at the same speed as mine, telling me what he won't. That he's as scared as I am. The news of my relocation doesn't go down well with everyone. Later that week, I meet Sasha and Ali for lunch at a coffee shop around the corner from Sasha's swanky new office. And Ali's too. Now that she's joined Sasha Hart Limited in a permanent position. I should have done it at the end of the working day, because the conversation results in floods of tears from all of us. I feel like I've just got you in my life and now you're leaving, Ali says, while Sasha is more self-reproachful. This is because I moved out, isn't it? You think I've abandoned you? You think I chose Roman over you? I think nothing of the sort. I'm laughing against her shoulder, pulling her in for a hug. I know it's a long way, and I know things will change, but I need to do this. I can't stand around my kitchen making videos forever. When do you leave? Ali asks, handing around tissues. Mid-December, I reply. 4 weeks to pack up my entire life. Not daunting at all. Celine's assistant emailed the details of an apartment in Brooklyn I can stay in for a few months until I find a place of my own. I start before Christmas. A quiet doubt creeps in, one I'm on first name terms with. My birthday in January. 1 year since I woke up back at 25 and my life couldn't look more different. I know I need to make this change. I know I'm sparing myself from misery, but still, a new city, alone. My future may no longer look bleak, but it's still scary as hell. How did Henry take the news? Ali asks. He's really happy for me, I say. I ignore the way my chest quivers in doubt. We're going to try long distance. We've already picked dates for me to come home, for him to visit me. There's an open invite for you both, too. Easter? Summer in New York? Any time. Ali is already pulling out her work calendar, marking potential dates. Sasha is quiet. At first, I think this is her way of showing her concern at us doing long distance. Until she says, I think I might have to pass on the travel plans. I'm going to have my hands full. What's new? Ali says. You're a workaholic. That's why I'm looking at dates now, so we can lock you in. In unison, Ali and I both notice how one of Sasha's hands has fallen to her lower stomach, how the other is revealing a black and white sonogram picture. Oh my God! We're screaming. How did this happen? When? Well, first I gave all my condoms to Grace, and then, Sasha begins saying. As she giggles, a tear falls to her cheek. There's an onslaught of questions. How far along? When's she due? How's she feeling? 12 weeks, due early summer, and terrible. I have never felt so unbearably ill, she says, or so unbearably happy. 12 weeks, Ali gasps. How did you manage to keep quiet? I'd have spilled within minutes. Sasha's expression falls. I didn't want to jinx it. It felt delicate. Roman and I went to one of those fertility specialists to see if it helped us make a decision on timing and things like that. They told me I already have the fertility levels of a 40-year-old, at 28. It wasn't impossible, but it was likely going to be a long, difficult journey. I walked out of there devastated, and it made me realise how badly I want this, how I want to be a mum. Roman and I started trying that night. I still can't believe it. Roman says we are the luckiest people in the entire world. I hold my heart for the journey she doesn't know she took to get here. I know things will be tough, what with the firm being so new and all, but, Sasha adds, you have a whole army behind you, ready to help. You have Roman and your family and us, Ali says, before pausing. She turns to look at me, eyes glistening. It's okay, I say.